Good morning. Yesterday I did a weird experiment. After Mincha, I went over to somebody and I said, I have a weird question for you. If I knock on your door on Friday night and I ask to borrow a coconut, why would you think I was asking for that coconut? So his first answer was, I wouldn't think about why you were asking at all. I would just bring you a coconut. And then he's like, well, I guess that you would want it for the juice, but basically for the coconut milk. And so, okay, that was the first part of the experiment. Then I said to him, what if I showed up at your house and I offered to crack a coconut for you with my hammer? Why would you think that I was making you that offer? And he thought for a second, because that's a little bit more weird. And he said, I think that you probably, the hammer is a klishim alachol the isser, and you needed an excuse to get it off your table.
How young is he?
He looked like he was in his 20s.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah, so...
That's what I'm not tracking.
For someone else?
It makes a difference. It's for him.
So that's what I was thinking on Tuesday. We posited the plausibility hypothesis, right? Which is that if a harama is plausible, meaning that if an onlooker could mistake my intentions as sincere, so then the harama is permissible. That was why Rav was allowed to bring the fishnets to Rav Kahana, because it's very possible, right, that Rav Kahana had a preference for sitting on fishnets, or that no chairs were available, or that this was just the regular custom. And Rav, himself may have been, half sincere, probably was half sincere. And for an onlooker wouldn't necessarily realize, or wouldn't know with certainty, that Rav was practicing a harama. However, the second case of the Gemara, where Rav Mari Barachel had those felt pillows, and he had tons of them in his house already, and he wanted to bring in the ones that were in danger of getting damaged. So there, Rava said that he's not allowed to bring in the felt pillows, even though maybe he'll have more guests than he has pillows. So we suggested again that the reason that harama was forbidden is because it does not pass the plausibility test. Because everybody, would realize that if Rav Mari Barachel brings in those pillows, he's not doing it sincerely. He's only doing it as an excuse to avoid getting into, to avoid losing these pillows to the, to Hilchos Mukta. And so I would say perhaps the same thing would be true. To borrow a coconut, right, I think would be allowed because people, okay, you must have some reason that you need a coconut. But to show up at your neighbor's door with a hammer, volunteering to crack coconuts for them, that I think would be a harama ha'asura, because there's no plausible explanation for that other than that you're trying to move something that's muksa in a tricky way. Yes. So the point that you're raising is an important point, meaning if a rabbi gives one person a psak that something is mutter, and another person a psak that the same thing is usur, it has the potential to confuse people about the halakhic system. And the truth is that growing up, I encountered a lot of that confusion. How come the rabbi told me that I cannot shop in this store, right? And yet he told my neighbor that he could shop in this store. How does that work? Either the store is mutter, right, or the store is usur. And this is something which I like to say frequently. It's that misunderstanding is based on a misunderstanding of the halakhic system in general. And I think it's a little bit of a mitzvah to publicize the more accurate understanding of the halakhic system. When a person asks a shaila to a rav, It's not like putting in a search in Google, where the rabbi goes through all of the data in his head, right, and just pops out, you know, the first, you know, 10, the top 10 responses using some sort of an algorithm. The Gemara says in a number of places that when you ask a shaila to a rav, you're asking the rav to take responsibility together with you for the consequences of your subsequent conduct. In other words, if you do something without asking the shaila, so the consequences are entirely on your shoulders. When you ask a shaila, right, to a rav, so the rav is now sharing responsibility for your actions together with you. The two of you are going to be holding responsibility for that together. And there are certain cases, right, where a rav would be willing to go out on a limb and say, I'm willing to shoulder this burden, right, together with you, for whatever reason, because I think that the cost-benefit ratio is going to lean in favor of the benefits and not in favor of the costs. But there are other situations where the benefits might be lower and the costs might be higher, and it could be for two different people. At the same exact shayla, one of them, it's not like I'm putting in an algorithm in Google and saying, oh, the answer is yes, or the answer is no. There's also shouldering responsibility. And so there might be one person, right, who needs somebody to hold their hand and needs somebody to take responsibility together with them. And for that person, I'll say, okay, this is my responsibility as a rav, right, to shoulder the responsibility together with you. But there might be another person who is more independent or at a higher level or a lower level or whatever it might be. And for that person, I wouldn't necessarily feel like shoulder, you know, like taking a share of that risk together with them. They don't need to take that risk. What are they going to get from taking that risk by shopping at the store? So there's a 20% chance that maybe, you know, that maybe the meat is not going to be kosher. They don't need to. Financially, they don't necessarily need to. In terms of where they're holding religiously, they don't need to. There's other stores where they can buy their meat that'll be a little bit more expensive. This family doesn't necessarily need it. I'm not going to take that 20%, you know, even half of that 20% risk, you know, chance, I'm not going to take for myself. There might be somebody else who really, really needs it. I remember I was one time learning with my chavrusa, Rabbi Natan Wiederblink, and a person came over and asked him a shaila, and I was positive. There's no heter for that shaila at all. And he told the person, mutter. So I said to him, mutter? Like, how did you just give such a heter? He said, you have to know where this person is coming from. He's coming from religiously. He's having a lot of trouble. And he's trying very, very sincerely and putting in a lot of effort, right, into maintaining, right, doing his best to live within a halakhic framework, even though it's very challenging for him. The fact that he came to ask this shaila, right, was a tremendous act of gevura on his part. And if I gave him a more strict sat, right, so it's very likely that he'll stop asking shilos in the future. So my responsibility right now, right, is to go out as far as I can on the limb, as long as there's some rationale, there's some posek, right, some sefer that says that it's mutter, I need to give him, you know, that hector because of where he's holding right now, and hopefully he'll be able to pull himself up from there. But anybody else, he wouldn't give, you know, that type of a hector. But that was a case where he felt that the responsibility to go out on a limb, right, and say, I'm going to share that chrayos with you. So again, you could call that, you know, shas hadachaf, you could call that, you know, bidi eved, you could call it a lot of names which actually exist within the halachic framework, but the basic philosophy is that answering the shayla is not just like doing a Google search. Answering the shayla also involves taking responsibility, right? And the rav has to weigh, you know, is it worth it for me, right, to take responsibility for this action, or is it not worth it for me to take that responsibility?
I understand on an individual basis. However, once that person leaves, he can say to somebody else, you know, I
can put it on the internet, and that's
wrong. Thank you.
So, you know, tzaddikim yalchubam, right? And
not in a bad way. The person doesn't leave and want to. There's any malice. It's just a matter of this is what they're upholding.
There's a story that I read from Reb Chaim Kanievsky that he was they printed something, his memories of the Chazon Ish, and the story goes that he said that there was once a person who came in to ask the Chazon Ish a shaila. And the Chazon Ish, he asked the guy to step out, and he turned to Reb Chaim Kanievsky, his nephew, and he said, watch, I'm going to tell him no, and he's going to walk outside and tell everybody there that I told him yes. Recognize the guy. So the Chazanish told him no, and sure enough, Reb Chaim followed him outside. Reb Chaim was young, probably maybe a teenager at the time, and the guy walked out and said, oh, the Chazanish said it's mutter. So I think that even if you're careful, you know, to only say something that you would be happy to have publicized, even then, like, there's no guarantee that it's going to be done, you know, correctly. You know, when you say, oh, one person says, oh, my rabbi said it was okay. And, oh, but the rabbi told me it was usur. Who says the rabbi said to him that it was okay? Maybe he's making it up, right? But even if he's not making it up, there still is this idea, you know, within halacha. So it's definitely true that in today's era of mass, you know, media, so you have to be more cautious, because what you say to one individual can spread beyond that. And there might be ways that you can phrase the answer. I think that in your circumstances, you should do this. Or I think in your circumstances, it's allowed. That might prevent, you know, misunderstanding. And it's a good idea if, you know, rabbis are savvy in terms of, you know, how these things get spread around. That it's a good idea to sort of revise and be very careful about the language with which, you know, Piskei Halach are offered.
Don't tell anyone else I told you this.
Well, you have to figure out what the person is going to understand, that this is not meant to be publicized. And even if it is publicized, right, it should be publicized not as this is the ruling, you know, for everyone, but this is the ruling for a particular person in a particular situation. And
that person will, somewhere down the road, when he does become to a murderer or whatever, right, he's going to use the same stock that he had before. The rabbi told me it's okay.
Right, he might.
Unless the rabbi explains to him that it's only at this particular time that I'm telling you.
It's on my shoulders. It's on my shoulders. This is what he needs, and there is a risk, and I'm willing to take the risk. And that's what a psak is.
We're going to 400-page tshuva for everything, and that's not the requirement.
But the Gemara in Horio says that there were rabbanim who, before they gave a psak halacha, they asked 10 other rabbanim to sign off on it. They said that way, in case, you know, it collapses, right? So I'm only going to take, you know, 1/10 of the blame. And it's explicit Gemara, right? That there's this idea that a psak is taking a risk, and you know that if you look through the tshuvas, you know, aguna shailas, mamzera shailas, and sometimes even, you know, less serious shailas. And in early modern Europe, in medieval Europe, you find very often that rabbanim will write, I think that there's grounds to be mafia this, but I'm not willing to sign off unless two other rabbanim sign off on it, or unless two other rabbanim of a certain stature sign off on it, or unless these two rabbanim sign off on it, or sometimes they'll make the number greater. You know, and it's for the same reason. It's because I don't want to be the sole bearer of responsibility when the risk is so high, and so we try to diffuse that, you know, responsibility by sharing it amongst other people. You know, just a lahavdil, a mar makom, is that in the Supreme Court right now, that seems to be the trend, that Chief Justice, you know, John Roberts, he likes to make very, very narrow rulings, which can't really serve as precedent in future cases. And there's a whole juridical, you know, methodology that he employs, so that when he gives a ruling in the Supreme Court, right, it's not the type of thing that you can now apply to a million other cases, but it's clear, right, from the way that he wrote his opinion, that, you know, that this is for this narrow case. And so I don't really know very much about his style, but it might be something that's worth, you know, looking at in terms of how one constructs that type of a narrowly applicable psak halacha. Yes?
Sometimes people about truth or something is not, but may not realize that, and therefore things come out that shouldn't necessarily, but typically when one is asking a shaila in general, one is asking for themselves, or one is asking for, if you're involved in the community, the rabbi answers appropriately for that group at that particular time. And one needs to know that process, or know that it's not necessarily for outside of that specific.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I find, you know, lamentable in halakha curriculum. right? Is that curricula, right? Is that very often it focuses on, in this case, you know, what do I do? And in that case, what do I do? And in the other case, what do I do? And there's a whole philosophy behind Pesach Halacha. There's a philosophy behind asking Shilos. There's a philosophy behind how Halacha is crafted, how Halacha is meant to be lived and implemented, and very often that's neglected. And what people, you know, have a sense of is that the totality of Halacha is, in this case, this is what I do. In that case, you know, that's what I do. Without, you know, the grandeur and the complexity, right, of the framework, you know, that lies behind it. And so one of the things that I'm experimenting with when I'm teaching, you know, Halacha in high school and in college is to what extent, because the philosophy is very heavy. And, you know, you can lose a large percentage of the class if you structure the class as a philosophy of Halacha class. And even when the kid asks a question that's just perfect, it's, you know, just, you know, there, slow pitch, right, you can hit it out of the ballpark. And I found that even in those situations, I can lose a good chunk of the class if I use the opportunity to go too, you know, too much into the philosophy of Pesach. And so I'm still calibrating to see how much, you know, awareness, you know, I can give. There are certain questions that are easier or cool than Chumras people are really, really into. That's like a good, you know, entryway to get into the philosophy of Pesach. But to get into something like taking responsibility, I find that there's less receptivity to that. But it, for sure, I think that it is a mitzvah for people to be better informed about the halachic system. It shouldn't be mystifying, because if it's mystifying, it very often can feel oppressive. And when a person is familiar and understands that there is an internally consistent system, right, that follows rules, and that the rules are, you know, reasonable, you know, rules and rational rules and compassionate rules, like either Rachel or Barachi Noam, that is something which really brings a lot more, you know, enlightenment and light into, you know, the halachic system and halachic practice. So that takes us through our haramos. Oh, I have it here, thank you. Okay, so the plan for the rest of today is we have one quick gemara to read about sweeping houses with brooms, which I'm going to read through very, very quickly. I don't have, you know, very much to say about it. All that we showed and talked about, you know, the relevance of sweeping is not so relevant nowadays because everybody's got, you know, wooden floors or carpet floors or tile floors as opposed to dirt floors. So we're going to go through that gemara very quickly, and then we'll look at the next scenario and we'll study the Mishnah and Gemara. You didn't answer the last scenario. Can I change, right? Can I change my place? Right, move my plate setting around for Kiddush and Hamotzi, or maybe at least, you know, for the whole meal, in order to have an excuse for moving the computer or the hammer, right, or calculator or whatever it was that was left on the table. It's not Shabbos day. You could, but I put a challah cover over it. I discovered that there was a tikkufa that the cover of my air conditioner didn't go on the air conditioner, and you know that air conditioners under their covers, right, the old type, right, it looked very, very ugly. So we discovered that if you take a beautiful white challah cover and you put like two, you know, heavy things, you know, magnets or whatever it is on top of them and hang it down over it, it looks even more beautiful than the natural air conditioner cover. It was really like an enhancement, like it was literally a decoration that was, you know, special with Kavod Shabbos, that we had this beautiful white, you know, cover that's on the Kavod Shabbos hanging over the air conditioner. So you definitely, if you want to make your table Shabbos stick, in spite of the computer being there, a better solution, right, without involving any haramos, might be put a nice, you know, challah cover on top of it. It might work better with a laptop or with a hammer. Something that's more bulky is harder to, you know, to conceal in an aesthetically pleasant way. But let's say, and let's say that it bothers you because you know what's under, right, that you know, that challah cover, and so you just want to have, you know, you want to do something to have a good reason to get it off the table.
Why does it even have to move? Why doesn't it just move it and rely on the
Well, that I think is not plausible. The question is whether wanting to sit at the tail of the table is plausible, right? Or whether that too is implausible.
Wasn't that the case of the Gemara? The orphan?
He said, no, I'm not sure. I have plenty for orphan.
Questions.
But at a certain point, that harama became awesome, right? Meaning, if you look, again, how big is your table? How many people are sitting there? If that's the only seat that's left, right? If that's the only seat that's left.
You need it for Shabbos. Right?
But the truth is that, you know, it may depend. So I don't think, have I ever had a case that a person knocked on my door and invited himself for a Shabbos meal without any prior warning?
It's tough.
According to us, I'm not sure it happened to him. Mm-hmm. Because he's living near the airport. So his cousin dropped in 2 minutes before Shabbos.
You all live near the airport.
Yeah. What?
You all live near
the airport.
People go for a rub a lot sooner.
But I mean, when I was a rabbi in Connecticut, we had a car full of people who were traveling to Boston, and they got stuck in traffic, and they called me up to arrange for them, a place to stay. I myself, was only a guest when I went to Connecticut, and so I couldn't, just say, come to me, and it wasn't Fairfield. So it definitely does happen, and I've known people in Garden Hills also, snowstorms or whatever it is. And there are people, who they go to yeshiva or they go to shul and they say, oh, is there anyone who needs, Shabbos meal? And they'll invite people, at the last minute. So it definitely does happen. But usually, what will happen in that case is that you'll have a little bit of warning from before Shabbos. The question is, do you ever have a case where someone literally knocks on the door, right, and says, hey, can I come in for a Shabbos meal? And ask my father, he has an amazing story about saying, Kol Dichvin Yesei V'Yechol, and somebody came into his Pesach Seder without any prior invitation or warning or anything. It was upstate. It was a very, very, very interesting story, but too long to
Las Vegas?
My daughter doesn't know who's coming to stay until they show up. Mm-hmm.
So it may depend. Again, I'm not sure whether this is measured by community or whether it's measured by the individual. But what I think I can say for sure is that if you have extra spaces at your table already, right, and this is just okay. So I have space for 7 guests, and now I want to clear this off for the 8th guest, who maybe will come and maybe won't come, that might already be stretching, the bounds of plausibility. So again, it's hard to say anything, hard and fast on this type of a question, because it really depends on what's plausible, what's implausible. I would be reluctant, to just make that call, right, on my own, not for myself, and not for other people, because after my assumption about the hammers, right, where I thought that nobody uses hammers to crack nuts anymore, and then Mr. Elias said, yeah, but I use hammers to crack coconuts. So I realized that my limited experience, right, with the world is just that, limited. And there are many, many phenomena and things that happen in the world that within my Kew Garden Hills cocoon, I'm just not aware of them. And so I think I would resort to asking other people what they think about the plausibility, rather than just passing it on to myself until I have a little bit more life experience. So that's why I'm not so sure that I would just rely on the guests, Hector, even though it is in the Gemara, but I'm not sure that I would rely on it exactly in that way. But what about this harama is conceivable, so I want to sit at the other side of my table. Plausible? I just have a Yetzer Hara to. If it's so severe that it's a grapshal ray, then you can move it because it makes you uncomfortable. But I'm talking about a case where the bother is not so severe. It's not like a dead mouse on your table.
Yeah,
And it's not bothering you that much. But it's teachable after the issues. You can't move a mikhan, you know. But no, this is even worse than Hamel itself. It's just because it's a low level, you know, bother and you know, discomfort. So the truth is, it might be different in every household. I mean, the answer to this, question might be different in every household. Meaning, I'm like trying to think about my own, you know, eating habits. So when I was first married, so sometimes I would sit at the head of the table, and sometimes my wife would want me to sit next to her. So we would both sit, you know, parallel, right, you know, at the side of the table. But that wouldn't justify going to the tail of the table. And now I very often eat at the head of the table and learn at the tail of the table. When I want to eat, when I'm learning, half the time I'll eat at the head, and half the time I'll eat at the tail. That's only during the week. And on Shabbos, I'm trying to think, I don't think I've ever sat at the tail of the table on a Shabbos. But maybe if I put out a sefer there, right, so like that would make it more plausible.
There's some people that always, the wife sits at one end of the table and the husband sits at the other.
Okay, well then it wouldn't be a problem at all. Then it would be a genuine, you know, tzarech limkomo.
So I think the second way is the best.
I'll suggest a test. I have to figure out if this works. But if you recall, Rashi said, why did Rav say, bring the nectar of Kahana so he can sit on them? Like, why those six words? So he can sit on them. So Rashi said that it helps the Harama if you articulate the sincere intention and leave the insincere one silent and in your thoughts. So I'm wondering whether this would be a good test, meaning this is going to help us determine the plausibility of the harama. Can you, with a straight face, articulate a sincere reason for doing what you're doing? So, in other words, I would need to say, this Shabbos, I am sitting at the tail of the table because I want to see my house from a different vantage point. That's not a haram.
No.
that's a reason that doesn't justify tiltol muksa. Not sorach, you know, gufo. It's not sorach mekomo. So I think that might be a good test. If you can articulate, right, a genuinely, you know, sincere reason for doing what you're doing, right? Something that sounds, you know, sincere, and that Mr. Kahneman is not going to say, yeah, right, to, right? So that, I think, would be a permissible harama. But if you can't really articulate a reason, right, with a straight face, a reason that you think would be somewhat plausible to some people, you know, who are listening, why do I want the coconut? Because my wife has a craving. It doesn't have to be true. It just has to be something that people, you know, can come up with, you know, as being sincere, right? So so that would already, you know, pass the plausibility test.
Was this ever suggested?
What?
No, not that if you want to move something, you just sit around it as long as you think.
There is a Gemara about one of the Amoraim who had some expensive equipment in his on his front porch, and it was raining, probably out of season rain, and he was nervous that it would get ruined. So he went to ask the Shiloh, what should I do? So his Rav told him, make a picnic, then the expensive equipment is going to sort of be ruining the ambiance of your picnic, the Shabbos, right? Mm-hmm. And so then you'll have a hefter to move it inside.
But the rain,
so that is only mutter, right, in a case when there's hefsid gadol. Again, you know, coming back, you know, to yesterday, that we don't want the person's, you know, Shmira Shabbos to compromise other aspects of their, you know, religious observance. We don't want it to make them into paupers. Right, because in those days, you know, finances were extremely tight, right? And you know, we don't want Shabbos, you know, to do that to the person, to put them in the poorhouse. And so he said, okay, you can take your, you know, you can make this harama to take the equipment. So that is clear that it only works, right, to use to turn something into a grapshal rei by moving your meal, right, to that place's location. That only works to makom, you know, has to goggle when a person, you know, is going to suffer a major financial loss on account of that. I'm just doing like a minor version. The muktzah here is not as serious as chesed and kiss. It's just a klishim alachol the iser. So we sometimes will be more lenient, but you know, parallel to that, the harama here is not as strong of a harama either, but that's kind of where I got the idea from. Okay, let's quickly take a look at the Groom Gemara, and then we'll turn to the next topic. We're going to start from... Yeah, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines from the wide lines. Last word on the line. Just go to six lines down from the wide lines. It's Kuf Kaf Dalet Amud Beis. Kuf Kaf Dalet Amud Beis. Wide lines and down six. Amar Rabbi Abba, Amar Rabbi Chia Bar Ashi, Amar Rav. It goes back to Rav. Machbedos, brooms, right? Shel Milsa that are made out of silk, which were usually machbedos mean brooms. Yes. Kibud habayis, that means to make the house more respectable. Right. So basically, brooms, if they're made out of silk, out of melas, mutar l'taltel on Shabbos, you can move them around on Shabbos because they're kelim shemalachon leheter. Right. These silk brooms are not used on dirt floors, right, but rather they're used on tables, and therefore there's no concern whatsoever of building or anything like that, and you know, leveling off, you know, the floor so that it should be even table. Right? You're not gonna do anything wrong with it. Aval shall tamara, if they're made out of, you know, date branches, right, then you make those into brooms, which are used for the floor low. Those you're not allowed to move on Shabbos because they're kalim shemalachon le'isser. We can already guess, right? We're talking about moving these brooms mechama le'tzel. That's the only case where there's a difference. The Gemara is just going to go through the reasoning to that. Rabbi Elazar says, "Afshal tamara, even the ones that are, you know, meant for sweeping the floor are allowed to be moved." So, b'maya skina, what are we talking about? Ilem letzorach kufo letzorach makomo. If you want to move the broom, right, to do something mutter, so then behalim arav shal tamara lo. Why can't you move a floor broom as long as you're not using it to sweep the floor? Move it for something else, you know, to sweep the table with the floor broom. Right? That's not a problem. Well, Rav, to Rava Sfirli, Rav holds like Rava, who says that you're allowed to move a queen shemalachto le'isser, the tzorach lupo, and the tzorach mekomo. Ella, hey, mechama letzel, it must be talking about moving the broom to prevent it from damage. So, beholim, Rabbi Elazar, afshel tomorrow. How come Rabbi Elazar says that you're allowed to move the floor broom? If the queen shemalachto le'isser, you shouldn't be allowed to move it. Mechama letzel. So the Gemara answers, la'olam, Mechama l'tzel, we're talking about moving it to prevent, to save it from damage. And Ema, v'chein amar Rabbi Elazar. Don't say that Rabbi Elazar argues and says you're allowed to move it. Rather says that Rabbi Elazar agrees, right, and says that you are not allowed to move the muktzah broom, mechama l'tzel. Okay, let's take a look at scenario number 12. This is a yontif scenario.
Page 11.
Yes. So it's Simchas Torah, and bags of candy abound, and in a gesture of extravagance, Yeshua decides to give out ice cream to its younger members.
Popsicles.
Oh, like the
popsicles.
Ice cream.
Exactly.
Okay, popsicle is fine. You happen to be collecting popsicle sticks for an arts and crafts project, and you'd like the children to give you the popsicles from their ice cream after they're finished licking. May they give you the popsicle sticks, and are you allowed to carry them home? So the reason that I'm talking about Simchas Torah as opposed to a regular Shabbos is because this is a shaila about nolad, about something that has undergone a significant change, right, between its state when Shabbos came in and its current state. And when it comes to nolad, so most types of nolad are permissible on Shabbos. Only something which goes from, you know, from one use, like the 180-degree turn to a totally different use, would be usher on Shabbos, right? But you know, but something which is a minor nolad, which still has some uses that are similar to its original use, will be mutter on Shabbos, but will be usher on Yom Tov, like we discussed on Monday, because of concern that people might not take Yom Tov seriously. They might think that all sorts of things are mutter on Yom Tov, which aren't. So we ramped up Hilchos Muktzah on Yom Tov in order that people should take it seriously. That's why the chicken bones, right, which are like this in-between nolad, or the you know, the pith of the peach, right, which doesn't have any fruit left on it, that's an in-between nolad on Shabbos, right? You would be allowed, you know, to move the bones because it's fit for animal consumption. On Yontif, you would not be allowed to because it's considered nolad. And so the question is, are these popsicle sticks considered to be nolad? Has their function changed between when the ice cream was on them and now that the ice cream is off of them, right? Or can you say that they're not considered to be nolad and that you're allowed to move them around, that as long as they're functional for something, that's already going to be okay? So, no, not with the food. This is the next mission.
The next mission.
I'll make a parenthetical note that last week, so my wife and I visited a museum where a sculptor made these very interesting sculptures of animals in motion out of broken pieces of plastic. So like there were spatulas and hangers, and these were the building blocks for all of the sculptures. So I don't think that's what we're talking about here. Like, I don't think we're talking about a case where there's a broken hanger and 999,999 out of a million people would just throw the broken hanger out, but the one, you know, artist, right, sees, oh, that's going to be perfect, right, for the, you know, the talon of my raptor or the fin of my dolphin, right, or whatever it's going to be. That's not what we're talking about. In that case, we would say, you know, bakla, daita, etzel, kal adam, that, you know, that...
He must be Jewish.
The sculptor?
Yeah.
It would be very interesting if she was. The name was very Chinese. But not a seer necessarily. I'm trying to remember now what the name was. Anyhow, so I don't think that's what we're talking about. You know, my wife is like, you know, walking around, and she's like, what are you thinking about? And I said, I'm thinking about... Anyhow, so that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about some sort of a new use that is relatively more common. I think that, you know, using popsicle sticks for arts and crafts is relatively, you know, common enough. All the magazines, like, they have, you know, these recycling ideas and fun with garbage. It's not like using, you know, the splinters of a hanger to you know, to make a sculpture of a dolphin. So the question is it nolad or is it not nolad? And as soon as we read the Mishnah, you'll already begin to perceive the relevance of the Mishnah, but there is an important machlokas amongst Achronim, which I want to draw some attention to, which we'll need to read a little bit more Gemara also in order to develop that machlokas. So let's take a look. Kol ha-kelim ha-nitalin b'Shabbos, shivrayen nitalin imahen. Everything which is not muksa, right, kli shemalachto leheter, right, kli shemalachto leisser even, you're allowed to move it on Shabbos. If it breaks on Shabbos, you're allowed to use the broken pieces, you're allowed to move the broken pieces as well. Bilvad, but only on condition, sheyehu osin me'ein melacha, that they're still suitable for something that resembles utility, for something that is going to, you know, help you out, help your life be more comfortable, help advance the cause of civilization, that it's some sort of malacha, right, that they're fit for performing. Shivrei areva, for example, if you have an areva, which is some sort of a cup, right, lechasos kohenes piachavis, and now that it's broken, you can't drink from it, but you can still use it to cover a wine bottle. People don't do that anymore, but in the olden days, when material was much more scarce, right, sometimes you would use a broken cup to cover a wine bottle. That way, you know, if a snake came out from under the baseboard in the middle of the night, it wouldn't be able to poison your wine because now the wine bottle is covered. What about shivrei zechuchis? Doors.
Yeah.
Right. Those were. Yes. Yeah. There is there'll be a bit of overlap between both this Mishnah and the next Mishnah and the first Mishnah. So, but here we're talking about when it's like literally like broken and it's not repairable.
Okay.
But you can still use it for something. So again, shivrei zechuchis. If you have broken glass, you can use it lechasos. Bohen es piapach, also to cover something, it's big enough shard that you can use it to cover something. So Rabbi Yehuda says, it's not enough that they're suitable to do some sort of malacha, but it needs to do something that resembles their original malacha. And an example of that would be shivri areva latsuk letofa mikpeh. If you had a cup and the cup broke, it's not enough that the cup can, that the shards can be used to cover something. That's not what you use a cup for. A cup is used to hold something. So now this broken cup you can't use to hold liquid, but maybe you can use it to hold something viscous, something like, you know, honey or molasses, right, or something like that, that you can dip your, you know, your bread into, right, or your meat into, or something like that, put ketchup on it so that it doesn't get on your tablecloth, right, that certainly is going to work. And shivrei shel zechuchis, latzuk letochan shemen, and again, if it's glass, you can use it to hold something which is not 100% liquid. Right? It's like when I get these frozen pizza things in Costco. Right? They come in cardboard boxes, right, of, you know, 8 slices, and you take this, you know, take the bag out, and then you put the cardboard box in recycling. So I had this innovation that I could recycle it at home without putting it into the recycling bin. So I basically ripped a piece off the box, and then I used that piece as my plate. Right? So that's being osa, I may aim the lachon, and it was meant for holding pizza, and now I'm still using it for holding pizza, but if the piece is too small, not on Shabbos, no, on Shabbos, but I guess on Shabbos I can eat for shashudis, maybe some other milchik dish, cheesecake, right? But if it's too small, right, if it's too small, so then it might be not, you know, osem ein malachton, and then it would be considered nolad, certainly on Yontif and probably even on Shabbos. If it's graf shel rei, yeah, you can move it. The same way that you can move it with your foot, right? Toko b'gufo is also always mutter in toko menatzad, as long as it's sort of a mutter, is going to be mutter. This is leaving aside all the permissible.
That's
going to ask you, but we're going to...
You can write your own tomorrow.
Well, then I can write my own question.
Yeah.
Have you learned this before?
No.
It's a story with your past.
Well, first of all, I learned that film. But I went to
my site. You have learned.
I must have learned.
No, I was going to think, you know, Rav Chaim has this famous story with Rav Chaim that somebody once quoted him a Tosfos, and Rav Chaim said Tosfos doesn't say that. And he said, I'm sure that Tosfos, you know, didn't say it. Rav Chaim later confided to his family, you never learned that Tosfos. But he knew from how Tosfos works that it's impossible that Tosfos said it. Right? So that's my data. Okay, so let's take a look, and let me just tell you the basic outline. So we have here a machlokes, right, between Rabbi Yehuda, right, and the Chachamim. And it's just important to break it down, like look at question 121. When Kalim break, sometimes everyone agrees you may move their fragments, and sometimes it's a dispute. So in what case does everybody agree that you can move it?
Similar purpose.
When the fragments are doing something similar, they're still suitable for something similar to the original purpose of the key. In what case is it a machlokes? When they're still suitable for something, right? But for something that's very, very different from their original purpose. So the Gemara's question is going to be, right, what exactly is behind the machlokes? Why is it that the Tanakhama is lenient in this case and says that you're allowed to move it on Shabbos? Option number one is because nolad is mutter on Shabbos. Right? This is only a half nolad, right? Because it still is suitable for something, and so it resembles its original state. It hasn't changed state entirely, and therefore you're allowed to move it on Shabbos because a half nolad is not mukta on Shabbos. That's option number one. I think the Taz maybe says that option. Option number two, the Tanakhama is lenient because he doesn't believe that this is nolad at all. It's not half nolad, which is mutter on Shabbos, but it's totally not nolad because originally it was functional and now it's functional, and that's all that we care about. It was a kli before, it's a kli now, and the fact that it's doing something slightly different shouldn't bother us. That's not a change. Right, it's not a change of function because everything is a widget. Right? By which I mean to say that a widget is like an all-purpose, right? You know, tool. Right? You use it for anything, but everything is a widget, meaning that there's no such thing as this water bottle is designated, right, for holding water, right, or this table is designated for putting things down on. Right? You know, with this table, you can turn it upside down, and it'll be a boat. That's its purpose too, right? So I think that may be the Tanakama's, you know, philosophy, right? That you know, everything at its deepest level, right, is just a widget, and therefore, as long as it's functional for something, it still retains its original designation. It may be closer to the truth, according to the Tanakama, according to some Achronim. But that's not going to stop me from telling my kids to turn the table right side up.
But this came to the top of the chart.
I'm not for sure. I mean, it's clear that the Gemara says if you have a fruit bowl, right, and there's a hole in it which is big enough for a fruit to fall out, so it becomes tahor. But you can still put.
They say if it can contain rimonim for certain type of kli, that it was very big and it could, instead of olives, it can contain rimonim, is still called kli.
Right, so I'll just excuse myself with Shlomo Zalman. Shlomo Zalman Arbach says that, you know, you cannot compare the definition of what's a kli for Hilchos Tuma or for Hilchos Mekilas Yadayim, right, or for any other area of halacha with the definition of a kli for Hilchos Mokzah.
I was only talking because the Mishnah, the Gemara, tries to needle and it goes into the Gemara. Right, it could have used just Mishnah.
Okay, I mean, there's an earlier Mishnah, which is even more clear, right? That stick that you're using for
right,
mixing the oil, right? It's not, muktzah, but it might still be tummy. Right? Again, the Gemara is going to, there's a Gemara on Kuk Hapei that goes against this, that seems to compare Tuma with Shabbos. Some posts can say that's only in a half amina, it's rejected at the end of the day. And there's other posts who actually say no. That it could be that for Kalim, we don't compare Tumah with Shabbos, but Shibri Kalim, we do compare Tumah with Shabbos, and that's a good discussion. But for Kalim, not for... So let's take a look here at the Gemara. We're going to try to tease out which lines of the Gemara seem to support the opinion that this is not Nolad at all, and which lines support the opinion that this is half Nolad, but nonetheless is Mutter on Shabbos. Again, the Naftamina is going to be on Yontif, when half Nolad is Aser, but something which is not Nolad at all is Mutter, right? And the popsicle stick might be the Naftamina. Right? It's still suitable for something, but not suitable for its original purpose. Yehuda would never say that it's mutter, but the Magen Avraham and the Taz might argue about whether these popsicle sticks can be brought home on Simchas Torah.
What was the original purpose of
the
popsicle stick?
The whole ice cream. Yeah.
You can't do it again. You can't freeze. You can use it again to. You have a mold. You put a stick in there. You put liquid in there, and it freezes.
Can't do it on top.
The issue with the yantif for this, I have a use for the sticks. The issue with the yantif, on yantif, I assume you could make a food thing.
I guess the issue making liquid into ice is an issue of molded, but I think that the sort of on that, we probably would permit.
Or I could take ice cream and for a little kid and pack it onto the stick or whatever.
Yeah, after washing it off.
It seems like there's a slight weakness in the case, but we understand it never let wash it off.
Functionally, you can do without washing it off. Maybe not the most hygienic thing in the world, but.
Again, going back to Kukhaf B, we saw that there's one concept which is called Ra'ui, right, Limalacha, and there's another concept called Omeid Limalacha. And of the two, Omeid Limalacha is the defining concept when it comes to Muksa. So we don't care about the fact that every rack and every branch that you find, right, on the floor could be used, right, as a game, and it could be used as a door stopper. Right, that doesn't make a difference. The needle, right, that's broken or that hasn't yet had the hole punched in it could be used for removing splinters, but it's not only the cap, because when the needle breaks, right, everybody just tosses it into the garbage. And so I'm not sure how many people recycle popsicle sticks for making new popsicles.
Most could be.
For years, I was keeping shirt cardboard.
Yeah. Egg boxes.
For project, that's what I said. Yeah. But here the question is maybe even Rabbi Yehuda agrees because you can use the stick, right, for making new popsicles. So that I'm not sure that you would do, that you would serve popsicles to one, you know, set of kids and then wash off the wooden sticks and make a new batch of popsicles on them.
No one does it. Okay. No one does it.
I have already declared my inexperience, but I think that there are people in this room who can tell us whether the popsicle sticks are recycled and are homemade for this purpose. Do you recycle popsicle sticks like that?
You use the thing. Oh, a doctor may use it. Hmm? Stick it down.
Right, and my mom is for sure going to use a used popsicle stick as a tongue depressor. They could arrest
me. Is that children
folks? The question is it omeid lakak? Right, not is it ra'ui lakak, is it omeid lakak? Meaning, do people use popsicle sticks for this? Arts and crafts, I know they use popsicle sticks for. Right. I'm not sure that people recycle the wooden popsicle sticks that they get, you know, in their Häagen-Dazs bars or whatever. Well, I think maybe they would just buy the bar just to get the popsicle stick. Especially if it has some sort of like a joke, written on it or something like that. Right, so if our sociological, research were to reveal that people do recycle popsicle sticks for making new popsicles, right, then even Rabbi Yehuda would agree. My gut reaction is, and I don't think that I've been soundly refuted, right, with any complete evidence, but my gut is that people don't reuse popsicle sticks, that they're not omeid for this, but they are omeid for arts and crafts. And so I would say it's osa me'ein malacha, but not me'ein malacha. Yeah, exactly. So I can't say. And again, the Chazon Ish, when he talks about Kalim, he lived in Eretz Yisrael in the 1940s, 1950s. Everything was recycled. There was nothing that you threw out. And you can see the imprint, right, that recycling culture made on his Pesach Halacha. And contemporary post-him are starting to say, whoa, this Pesach of the Chazon Ish comes from his recycling, culture mentality. And nowadays perhaps it would not necessarily be the same. And so it's definitely true that if things were to change and people recycle popsicles and making new popsicles, then again, there's no shaila at all. And I'm talking about in Kew Garden Hills. Right? Within the cocoon, I think that this assessment is a good assessment. Have a good Shabbos. Thank you. Popsicles?
No,
it
just
has to
do. I mean, you make
projects. Okay, projects are what we're saying. Yeah.